And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And Phil Conlon, our partner, will be here shortly, we assume. And we're going to talk today to a very important news source, I'd call him, Rick Rossoff. I'm going to give you the address of that, of a major site that he is responsible for. It's called, you go to Rick Rossoff, RickRossoff.wordpress.com. It is Stop NATO, and NATO is becoming more and more the center of all things on every quarter of the globe. So we're going to be talking to Rick about developments in a number of places. One announcement I want to make here before we get to Rick, and that is that on Friday, December the 2nd, at Sydney Smith Building, room 2117 at 100 St. George, University of Toronto, 7 p.m., Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report is going to be speaking, and he has been one of the major voices opposed to the attacks on Libya and the terrible consequences of those attacks on black population of Libya, and also as a reflection of attitude within the continental USA of towards black Americans. And so that's December the 2nd, and it's going to be Glenn Ford at 7 p.m. And I think we're joined now by Rick Rossoff. Are you there, Rick?
Yes, I am, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's great to be talking to you. You've got one of the most important websites, in my opinion, Stop NATO, and then people go to rickrossoff.wordpress.com. Of course, they can always just go Stop NATO, and they'll get right to you, I think.
It will be. And you know, when I heard about the notice about Glenn Ford coming. If you want to talk about key, keen geopolitical analyst, Mr. Ford is one of them. You know, he sees the relationship, of course, between Africa and global politics, I think, as astutely as anyone I know. So I just wanted to put in a recommendation.
Yeah, I'm really glad you do mention that. Yes, he's got works from a concept, I guess, of domestic policy as foreign policy. Black Americans have really caught it from the people who run America, and so you look at the foreign policy when they go in the Middle East. It's the Africans of Libya that got the worst of it. I want to ask you, and starting with that subject, because he will be talking about this. Is we're getting more, of course, news by the hour from the Libya, from the overthrow of that government. And now the son of Muammar Gaddafi has been captured. The role of NATO in that tends to be kind of moved back now, doesn't it? I mean, they're talking about where they might try him as though it's the local guys, the guys in Tripoli who are going to decide. Who do you think is going to really make the decision about that? And if you could just comment on NATO's role in this whole episode.
I mean, as you know, that Saif, the captured son of Muammar Gaddafi, has a bandaged hand where he was injured in a NATO airstrike on the convoy that was leaving Sirte, at the time his father was murdered. So NATO's role is pretty direct, I would say, in that. He would not be a captive. He would not be injured. But for the fact that French warplanes fired laser-guided missiles, and the U.S. fire, or laser-guided bombs, rather than U.S. Predator drone fired a Hellfire missile at a convoy of some 20 vehicles leaving Sirte, which is to say, not engaged in combat operations, in fact, fleeing them, if anything, and, this is considered fair target. You know, I remarked very early, and I think I wasn't the only one, that what was going on in Libya beginning in March of this year, for the first 13 days, the bombing campaign and the naval blockade were run by U.S. Africa, U.S. Africa Command, Africa, under the name of Operation Odyssey Dawn, at which point on March 31st, it was transferred to NATO, what was called Operation Unified Protector. The speculation now, of course, you're asking what NATO's continued role, I suppose, it's not perfectly clear, but it appears as though it's going to be a joint project, as the war was, in fact, between NATO and Africa. Mm-hmm. That is, NATO officially ceased its role on October 31st, but there have been remarks by General Secretary Anders Fogh Rasmussen that NATO would be prepared to, because it has vast experience in these matters, I'm paraphrasing them, essentially build an armed forces for the Libyan, the new regime from scratch. Then we had the U.S. Permanent Representative to NATO, Ivo Dalder, following up on that by a few days by stating that Libya is a likely candidate for NATO's Mediterranean Dialogue military partnership.
I hear the word dialogue.
yeah, I mean, that's a euphemism. But, you know, keeping in mind of all the North African countries, from Egypt and the east to Morocco, and actually further yet, down the Atlantic coast to Mauritania in the west, have been members of this NATO military partnership since the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. Two Middle Eastern countries, Jordan and Israel, are also members. So, you know, in part, the overthrow of the Gaddafi government in Libya is, you know, many of us said even before the bombing campaign began, was to not only install a new government, but to bring the only remaining North African country outside of a NATO partnership into their fold. And then, in addition, as the Chinese analysts remarked 3 years ago, the U.S. and NATO have been attempting to set up strategic naval bases in North Africa. Libya would present them with that opportunity. It's also possible North Africa could host the headquarters of U.S. Africa. Mm-hmm. As to Gaddafi's son, we know recent events that when former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic was captured and taken to The Hague, they made the mistake, perhaps the West did, permitting him to defend himself. And anyone who read the transcripts of the trial, they're lengthy, the trial went on for a long period of time, he did an extraordinary job of refuting the accusations against him, and had it been better publicized, would have given a black eye to NATO. I suppose that wasn't going to be permitted to occur again. So when Iraq was invaded in 2003, then, the West permitted him or encouraged the fact that he would be tried locally so that he could be hanged. Mm-hmm. If the ICC or the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia or so forth are involved, most of the European countries, including those hosting them, have laws against capital punishment. So the West would probably prefer or defer to their clients in Libya and permit Gaddafi's son to be tried there so he could be killed.
Yeah, and to kind of lay this narrative that, oh, they're independent now. Everywhere they go now, I notice that the rest of us move on, and the people they put in power, nobody asks about. I mean, if I could actually make reference to Ivory Coast, UN and France actually acted like military allies, and they removed a government that was involved in a constitutional dispute as to who had won an actual election. And now the world's forgotten, and the president is in the hands of his enemies, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And with who knows what facing him. But, you know, it's a peculiar thing. I don't know if we've talked about it before, Phil. But in the post-Cold War period, the only people being tried for war crimes are former heads of state who used their security apparatus against violent uprisings in their own country and cross-border attacks within their own country. So if you look at countries, Yugoslavia, Macedonia, where military officials are being tried for war crimes, can you believe that?
Yeah.
For events in 2001, because, U.S.-backed so-called Kosovo Liberation Army-linked forces, armed insurgents, were invading the country from NATO-occupied Kosovo, and the Macedonian government having the temerity to do what they're elected to do, I suppose, defend their own country and citizens. Foreign attacks are being tried for war crimes. And a similar thing happened in Yugoslavia, Iraq, obviously, but also Liberia, Sierra Leone, mm-hmm. Ivory Coast. This seems to be a tactic that will be used in Africa with great vengeance. Yeah. But if you're a Western superpower or the client thereof, you can wage acts of military aggression around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the words war crime, war crimes, rather, are never used in reference to you. So we have this Orwellian inversion. Mm-hmm. The Nuremberg principles, where if you commit an act of aggression, a war against peace,
that's a crime.
Acceptable.
That's the one.
Yeah, but if you defend, if you use, as let's say the Assad government is doing in Syria, without speculating on the details about it. No?
Yeah.
They have not invaded Turkey. They have not sent troops into Jordan. They have not committed an act of military aggression, but, you know, watch down the road in the next couple of months if the, you know, speculation about trying Bashar Assad for war crimes doesn't arise.
Yeah, it's a crime of, they have this in North America, apropos of black Americans, of resisting assault. That is, if a policeman stops you and beats you up, then they, and you raise your hand, you're in trouble.
This is the international equivalent thereof. Yeah, you're correct.
This is Rick Rozov, and a great site, Stop NATO, and you can go to rickrozov.wordpress.com. I just I wanted to ask you about, you referred something to Liberia, and I don't know if you're following this, but I'll toss this out. We have this woman who won the Nobel Prize. Her name is Sirleaf Johnson, and they had what they called an election process. One of the opponents in the contest, and who later stepped out in order to enable her to take power, his name was, I think, Prince Johnson. And he was famous years ago for being in a video of the involving the torture of former President Doe, in which he is seen having a beer and ordering his lieutenant to cut the ear off Doe.
Yes, Samuel Doe.
But he's welcome. He's welcome and happy and sitting in Liberia. And Charles Taylor
is facing war crimes.
Yes, is in a war crimes. Quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Again, it's an inversion of everything that you know, a rational person would understand, and certainly everything coming out of the Nuremberg trials. Mm-hmm. You know, after World War II, where is a recall. I mean, you know, the Western world seems to have forgotten this conveniently, but crimes against peace, a crime against peace was considered to be the preeminent crime out of which all others grew. Mm-hmm. Including war crimes and genocide and the crimes against humanity. And now it's been reversed. And to, you know, we were talking about the North Atlantic Treaty Organization or the United States. Over the past 12 years, have waged full-fledged wars against sovereign nations. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking, of course, of Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and now Libya. Iraq was not technically a NATO operation, though it had NATO assistance before, during, and to this very day. Mm-hmm. You know, the armed forces of Iraq are being trained by something called NATO Training Mission Iraq, you know, by the thousands, including training their senior officer corps, training so-called oil police. That's the official
oil
title.
Police.
Yeah, oil police being trained by NATO. And it's, you know, I've been saying for years.
No police for oil.
Yeah, right. Not a bad slogan. Not a bad bumper sticker. But that, you know, when the last U.S. soldier departs the country, NATO will still be there. And that seems to be one of the roles the North Atlantic Treaty Organization has been, you know, appointed by the United States. They do the cleanup work in so-called post-conflict zones. They're also in charge now in something modeled after NATO Training Mission Iraq, NATO Training Mission Afghanistan. And according to the comments I just cited earlier by Rasmussen, the Secretary General of NATO, apparently Libya is the next country where they're going to build a NATO interoperable armed forces.
It's curious how confident they are of this, since they say they've created a new independent government. They say, well, there's a new independent government that's going its own way, and it will have this, and it will have that, and it'll all have the NATO brand.
Well, let's look at the prototype of this in the, you know, the Serbian province of Kosovo in 1999. After a peace treaty was signed, or at least an armistice, 50,000 NATO troops poured into the province. They eventually brought about the unilateral declaration of independence in 2008, and Kosovo is still not recognized by, you know, perhaps 60% of nations in the UN, members of the United Nations, notwithstanding, you know, handsome and at times.
And by the way, wasn't the original language all agreed to? Oh yes, that's part of Serbia.
Yeah, but of course they never contested.
They all said that, and then they did this to them.
And we see the current head of state is Prime Minister Hashim Thaci. If you want to know what a NATO-sponsored puppet regime looks like, I would argue that Mr. Thaci is the perfect archetype. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been implicated recently by Dick Marty with the Council of Europe's report on, you know, one of the more grisly things that's happened in our lifetime. You know, the reported abduction and murder of several hundred civilians that have their organs harvested. And gangs that Thaci is affiliated with, in fact, may head up, are directly implicated in running these operations.
That's so extraordinary. I remember first hearing that, and I thought I put that on the shelf as not likely. But now it's turning out to be certified, backed up by all kinds of evidence.
Well, the revelation came from Carla Del Ponte in her memoirs, and she, of course, was the chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, could hardly be accused of being pro-Serbian. She was quite the opposite. So that when the revelation came from her, it could not be ignored, and an investigation was impaneled, and it's produced the results it has, which seem fairly incontestable.
Yeah. Rick, I have to ask a rhetorical question. It just always occurs to me when I'm hearing all this information from you that I have this feeling that we are losing World War II.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like it's all accomplished is being taken from us, and everybody's being told we should applaud.
You know, that's a very good way of putting it. Just as I would argue, starting in the 1980s, that the Ronald Reagan administration undid or reversed the effects of the New Deal period in the 1930s. Similarly, what we've witnessed, the last 20 years, is that we've had a reversal of the effects of World War II. And we don't have to go any further than statements by former President George W. Bush when he appeared in places like Latvia and Georgia and denounced the summits that occurred at the end of World War II and then after that, and he meant particularly the Yalta and Potsdam summits. Mm. Denouncing them and so forth is in a manner that Hitler...
Somewhat said. Sacred agreements to us. We went to a lot of trouble to accomplish. Well, as a matter of fact, it's at your site, and this is Stop NATO, and this is Rick Rozov, rickrozov.wordpress.com. I learned that in the new state, NATO-friendly state of Georgia, they put up a statue to Ronald Reagan.
Yes, that's right.
That tells us a lot. I do appreciate very much your website for learning where I learned it.
Yeah, it's a crude bronze statue of him sitting on a bench, with his legs folded and maybe a hand on his knee or something. And the way the Georgian government, here's another madman who is the darling of the West, Mikhail Saakashvili. I mean, he and Hashim Thaçi. I mean, it's simply the case. I invite your listeners to pay attention to this. Of all the heads of state in the world that the United States and its NATO ally seem to have embraced unequivocally, passionately, it's precisely Thaçi and Saakashvili. Two more psychopathic individuals I don't think you could find, but, and it says a lot about the Western values. But
and what they're up to. I mean, by the way, we should remember, I recall the Democratic Party candidate and the Republican Party candidates talking about how we have to come to the aid of Georgia after it attacked an independent neighbor, and basically it was an open attack on the Russians.
Well, it was.
Which could have gotten us all killed.
It was a brutal attack on what is now proclaimed to be an independent nation at that time, breakaway Republic of South Ossetia, where some 85 to 90% of the populace held Russian passports, meaning they're Russian nationals. You kill a South Ossetian, you're killing a Russian. But several days before the invasion of South Ossetia by Georgia, which was timed to coincide with the opening ceremonies of the Olympics in Beijing, where the world's mind presumably would be off these matters, and perhaps Georgia could get away with a blitzkrieg campaign. Their intent was to move to the northern part of South Ossetia, block off something called the Roki Tunnel, which is how Russia would reinforce their military, and having done that, effected a fait accompli. No? One should...
They left out the detail that they didn't have soldiers who knew how to fight.
Though NATO and U.S. trained. I mean, there's a train and equip program the U.S. has been running with Georgia for 10 years now. It started with the Green Berets. It's been shortly thereafter transferred to the U.S. Marine Corps, which is still in Georgia training their armed forces. Georgia is soon to be, with a boost in their troop numbers in Afghanistan, they will outstrip Australia as the largest troop contributor for NATO's war in Afghanistan of any non-full NATO member. But we should recall that the United States and NATO allies were holding military exercises in Georgia days before the invasion of South Ossetia in August of 2008, and that hundreds of U.S. Marines were still in the country when the war began. We should also recall that Georgia was one of the largest contributors. This is you know, precondition for their getting into NATO, of troops in Iraq at the time, and that the U.S. transported some 1,500 or 2,000 Georgian troops from Iraq back to Georgia during the war.
Phenomenal.
You know, so you can, you know, the U.S. claim that, you know, they tried to hold back their pit bull or something is stuff and nonsense. I mean, they were directly complicit before the event, during the event, and immediately afterward.
Yeah.
This was a proxy war like so many others.
Yeah. Now, one of the things we get, I believe, reading your site, is that we don't comprehend, and it's very important Canadians to think about this, because so much, today's headlines here, the Globe and Mail and Star talking about this, that assurances that we're going to go, we'll be involved in Syria and mm-hmm. we'll be involved in this other thing. Is it what you describe is that NATO really plays with fire? I mean, everybody seems to assume that you can just keep doing these things and nothing bad will happen. But it is, what you're describing, extremely dangerous business that they're engaged in, right?
Yeah, it's gamesmanship, it's brinkmanship, it's taunting, it's almost, and this is one of the ways I interpreted the five-day war in the South Caucasus in August 2008, testing an enemy's resolve, testing an enemy's defenses, testing their strategies. This is, you know, extremely adventurous and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who knows where it is next. Look, the world right now is on tenterhooks in relation to Syria, in relation to Iran. I'm sure I'm not the only one on either end of this broadcast who wakes up every morning wondering if when I turn on my computer I'm not going to hear that there have been missile strikes in Damascus or in Tehran.
Indeed. I mean, they actually, I mean, part one of the population is being prepared for this. They're talking about softening up Syria, but we are being prepared, right? We're being prepared to accept this. Nobody's saying, well, now, wait a minute, that's outlandish. You can't be talking about, you can't be serious. We're being told, oh, yes, you know, we're on this, you know, we're going to. Actually, by the way, the psychology here, and I know you know an awful lot about this, is that Canada's finally becoming a respected little wolf in the pack of big wolves. And so, it's, you know, we're going to have a submarine. We're going to do this and we're going to do that. And then, again, without the Canadian population, which, by the way, is not enthusiastic, when they take a poll, there's no enthusiasm for any of this. But the drums keep being beaten. I have to ask you about a number of things, but one of them is, I know you have commented on Canada's peculiar attitude towards the Arctic, because this is a big heroic sovereignty story here. What is the NATO make of this exercise, and what is Canada angling for?
You know, this is worth discussing in some more detail in the future, but I'll flash back to January of 2009, the outgoing George W. Bush administration in the U.S., issued a national security directive on the Arctic. It, first of all, reiterated the U.S. Claim that the Northwest Passage is an international waterway and is not, as Canada contests, you know, surrounded on both sides by Canadian land, is not Canadian territory. This national security directive additionally says U.S. has the right to do perform military patrols, including missile defense activities in the Northwest Passage. Mm-hmm. As your listeners know, Canada and the U.S. have territorial disputes in the Beaufort Sea.
Mm-hmm.
On the other end of Canada, the eastern end, Denmark, you know, contests the Hans Island near Ellesmere, with Canada and so forth. Nevertheless, when Russia roughly 6 years ago renewed territorial claims based on what's called the Lomonosov Ridge and the Mendeleev Ridge, in the Arctic Ocean, Canada immediately started what they called sovereignty exercise, Operation Nanook.
Sovereignty calisthenics.
Yeah, you're right. However, I mean, this is why I was just saying earlier, this has nothing to do with sovereignty, because starting not this past summer with Operation Nanook, but the preceding summer, though actually for both of them, for the first time ever, non-Canadian military forces were brought in to participate, and they are from, guess which two countries, the United States and Denmark. That is the only two countries pressing, you know, involved in Canada, mm-hmm. With Canada rather, in territorial disputes, yet they're NATO allies. What happened a couple of weeks after the January 2009 National Security Directive for the Bush administration was that NATO held an unprecedented meeting in Iceland, a meeting on what they called the High North. And, of course, four of the five countries with direct territorial claims in the Arctic are NATO members. They're Denmark, the United States, Canada, and I'm drawing a blank, Norway. So that, you know, the idea that you're using the, lupine metaphor earlier, it's, five wolves and a dog sitting down to negotiate, are they going to carve up a carcass?
Yes.
The fact is NATO met in February, early February of 2009. And this is, not only the General Secretary of NATO at the time, but, their European commander, their Allied Command Transformation Commander in Norfolk, Virginia, all the big brass. And the fact that it occurred immediately after the U.S. National Security Directive, can hardly be seen as a coincidence. In fact, it looks like a coordinated policy. Mm-hmm. And that what this was a joint Western strategy to offset Russian claims in the Arctic Ocean, but one that could easily lead to. And let's talk about what the Harper government, I should use a term that Canadian and American press agencies use, the Harper regime.
Yes,
the regime of strongman, despot, tyrant, the tyrant Harper, he is talking about purchasing, anywhere from 65 to 90, I think, U.S. Joint strike fighters, F-35s, at what could be a total cost, not just for the purchase of the planes, but maintenance and replacement and so forth, of $29 billion. He's talking about upgrading Canadian destroyers and frigates at a cost of $25 billion. He's talking about replacing four diesel submarines with nuclear submarines at a cost of at least three $3 billion per submarine. That's another $12 billion. You're talking about $66 billion in proposed arms acquisitions. The submarines are going in the Arctic Circle. There's no question about that. The Canadian government officials, like Defense Minister Peter MacKay and others, are openly talking about using these submarines under the polar ice cap. Well, who could they possibly be directed against if not Russia?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the Harper administration has also deployed Israeli-made Heron drones in the Arctic Circle, the frigates the destroyers and cruisers, by the way, could easily be incorporated in what's called the Aegis combat system that the U.S. has started with allies like Norway and Japan and others to equip them for missile defense purposes, so-called missile defense purposes, interceptor missiles, Standard Missile 3. In which case, Canada upgrading its naval fleet could easily make it compatible with the U.S. Global interceptor missile system. Once you put components of that in the Arctic Circle, you're going to make the people in Moscow as nervous as they've ever been.
Yeah, there was at one time a kind of an agreement, not to militarize the region, right?
Yeah.
Maybe once you send nuclear subs under the ice, I guess it's all. solves that problem.
Perhaps 2-3 years ago, Britain and the United States held joint exercises with the nuclear submarines under the Arctic Circle, and it only made the news because of an accident that resulted in the death of one, and perhaps it was two British service members. And but for that, you wouldn't have known it was occurring. My contention has always been that Russia is the only country, along with the United States, which has a nuclear triad. It has both long-range bombers that can deliver a nuclear payload. They have intercontinental ballistic missiles, and they have submarine launch ballistic missiles. Mm-hmm. In the event that the Reagan, Star Wars project, and the reference to the Strategic Defense Initiative, but the reference with by the U.S. Missile Defense Agency to their new global missile program, is amongst the insiders known as Son of Star Wars, and with good reason. That effectively what this prepares the United States and its NATO and its Asian and its Middle Eastern allies to do is to be prepared to launch blistering first strike attacks against another country that has missiles, and then whatever survives that initial attack, not preemptive, it's the first strike, whatever in their silos survives that first attack then can be neutralized with what they call kinetic or hit-to-kill interceptor missiles. But my argument would be this, that the least vulnerable part of the Russian triad in the event of such a scenario would be their nuclear submarine force. And the last place they have to hide in the world is under the Arctic, polar cap in the Arctic Ocean. And if Canada is going to join the United States, Britain, and other NATO allies in that part of the world, you know, at the top of the world, mm-hmm. I would have to think, if I were in strategic planning in the Russian military, I'm saying they wiped out our last, comparatively safe haven for potential retaliation.
Yeah. It's just extraordinary. By the way, I got to remind everybody, we're talking to Rick Rozoff, and we really appreciate the time. RickRozoff.wordpress.com. Stop NATO. And this matter of NATO gets – it used to be on the agenda here to debate. And what has happened in Canadian politics, and I suppose the U.S., but it's NATO is now just kind of assumed to be there. For example, during the Libyan exercise last summer, Canadians said, well, okay, we've been there 3 months, 6 months. When are we going to discuss what we'll do? And they said, well, we'll talk about it in August or something. And then the way they discussed it was to bring in Canadian military people from NATO together with somebody from another NATO country to explain to our parliamentary committee what was going to be done, and then the parliamentary committee pretended that that was an exercise in democracy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of what I find is how alienating this is. I mean, you would think that a fact-finding matter about what should be done in Libya or what's the reality would start with our own parliament, our own system, electoral system, and where you would send somebody to go find out. You wouldn't ask NATO. You'd say, no, this is Canada. We'd like to know, and we're conducting our own investigation. If you go to NATO, that's like going to the boss, right?
Similar thing happened in 2000 in the United States, where members of the U.S. Congress, Dennis Kucinich and others, were raising the issue of repealing the mandate for U.S. troops in Kosovo. And what the Clinton administration did then, Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State Clinton, was they brought George Robertson, you know, at that time the Secretary General of NATO, to the United States, who was, you know, a bullying, blustering buffoon to begin with. Mm-hmm. And, was making, offering diktat mm-hmm. to the U.S. Congress, you know, basically telling them what to do and what they couldn't do and so forth. So here you have a, an English NATO chieftain, telling the U.S. Congress to get in line, that they had no business, mixing in big boys' business.
Yeah. I mean, it is it's rather like what we're seeing. Maybe it's an analogy with the situation in Europe where the IMF and others, or the European Union, I guess it is, they say to Greece, we think you have to get rid of your prime minister,
yep. mm-hmm.
and they do. And then they say to Italy, you're going to have to get rid of your prime minister, and they do.
Yeah, and they have a Papademos and a Monti, a handpicked, who, particularly in the case of...
You need a bureaucrat from our organization.
That's correct. And it's no coincidence the European Union and North Atlantic Treaty Organization headquarters are in the same city. And, there's a lot of interchangeability.
Maybe they do lunch.
Well, during the war against Yugoslavia in 1999, Spain's Javier Solana was Secretary General of NATO. He went on to become the position that Catherine Ashton has now, I believe, with the European Union, which is effectively the collective foreign minister of the European Union. So, I mean, they move in and out of NATO and the EU. As the EU becomes increasingly more militarized with, Nordic battle groups and, the first naval deployment in the Gulf of Aden off the coast of Somalia, and, taking over NATO operations in countries like Macedonia and Bosnia and so forth. So, I mean, they're a very well integrated mechanism. And the United States, NATO, and the European Union, different bureaus at the same department.
Mm-hmm. It's just phenomenal. This is Rick Rozoff, rickrozoff.wordpress.com. And Canada is telling us this morning, Mr. McKay and others, that they're getting ready for the Syria thing. And I think we should make sure we ask you about that. Wouldn't you assume that this is blocked out in terms of a plan, right? I mean, there's always this pretense, well, we're thinking about this, and We just had a visit from Mr. Barak from Israel. I noticed he gave a talk. Assad is done, he says. That means that they already have a kind of a four-step program. Is that right, would you think?
Yeah, of course they do. And you're correct about the statement by Ehud Barak, who was at the Halifax Security Conference along with NATO and U.S. And other allied officials from around the world. And the press reports you're referring to in the Globe and Mail and in the National Post in the last 24 hours, I believe the warship is the Vancouver. It's a cruiser that is currently in the eastern Mediterranean, kind of lingering after the October 31st official end of the NATO operation against Libya. It replaced, and I understand in the future, will again be replaced by the Charlottetown, which engaged in these guided missile cruisers, and they, you know, fired missiles. I believe they are. And your listeners can tell me if I'm wrong. But this is all, again, sleight of hand. With the official ending of Operation Unified Protector on October 31st, what Canada has done with the Vancouver is simply reassigned it to NATO's Operation Active Endeavour, which is a comprehensive surveillance and interdiction operation throughout the length and breadth of the Mediterranean Sea that is now in its 11th year. It was part of the activation of NATO's Article 5 Mutual Defense Clause after the events of 9/11 here in 2001. Everyone knows about Afghanistan, the 4,500-some Canadian troops in the deadliest province in the country, in Kandahar. But people don't tend to remember, don't know, that NATO effectively took over the Mediterranean Sea with its, you know, with its ships. And what's going to happen with the Canadian ship that is you know, now with the end of NATO operations in Libya, the blockade and the attack, is simply being reassigned to Operation Active Endeavour, which focuses on the eastern Mediterranean. And guess which country borders that sea? In the east, and it's Syria. So it's logical this would be a continuation of the Libyan campaign against Syria. I might add the campaign against Libya began when NATO assigned AWACS aircraft that had been working with Operation Active Endeavour for AFRICOM's Operation Odyssey Dawn. So this goes back and forth, and a lot of these, again, are, you know, shifting of categories that are more technical than practical.
Yeah. This is Rick Rosoff, and I got to say, speaking of this danger, by the way, this is going to, I think everybody agrees, whatever happens in Syria is going to be a lot more complicated and rich in danger for everybody. And there's two states in the area that I want to know your thoughts about. There's Turkey, which seems to be suffering with a kind of personality disorder.
Well put.
They, on the one hand, they are beat their chest and they are going to stand up to Israel. Then the weather changes and they seem to be acting very subservient and talking about how they're allowing soldiers from Syria now to build a camp in Turkey.
There was actually
what did they have? And there's talk about the new Ottoman. Is that a NATO, kind of a new NATO label for what they're doing? What's Turkey up to?
You've raised a lot of interesting questions. I'll try to be as concise as I could. At the end of the Cold War and with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, it was clear that Washington, in the first instance, was empowering Turkey under different political leadership, incidentally, for what was reported to be a slogan from the upper ranks of the Turkish military about Turkish influence from the Balkans to the Great Wall of China. That is, the Turkic-speaking world, by which I include the, you know, the five former Soviet Central Asian republics, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan,
and
Kyrgyzstan,
and part of Iran.
Parts of Iran, Azerbaijan, which is, you know, Shiite by religion, but Turkic by language. And, you know, to set up, you know, kind of a revival of the Turkish-Turkic world. With the Bush administration, starting in 2001, that went into abeyance, and Turkey was, you know, delegated a much smaller role within general Western strategy, in addition to the almost daily humiliation of being spurned for European Union membership, because they weren't Europeans. We now see emerging is what you've described accurately as a neo-Ottoman policy, or even more revealing, I've heard it referred to as a Sunni strategy. And I think that's even more...
Very scary.
Yes, it is, because it suggests, for the first time since Ataturk, you know, since the first time since the Turkish Revolution of a century ago, that there are forces forces in Turkey that would like to reassert influence in, if not control over, the broader Arab world, and that currently the way to do that is to play off denominational differences within Islam, mm-hmm. and seem to be the standard bearer of Sunni Islam, role traditionally delegated
which
to Saudi
will
Arabia.
Will be labeled moderate.
Yeah, moderate as opposed, say, to the Saudis. Yeah. And that what that would mean immediately, of course, is challenging Iranian influence in the Arab world, mm-hmm. With Shia religious groups in Syria and Lebanon, in Bahrain, in other countries in the Arab world, in which case would we may be seeing as a confluence of Turkish interest, U.S. NATO interest, and let's not forget the interest of the eight monarchies in the Arab world gathered around the Gulf Cooperation.
The vanguard of democracy there.
Yes, right, the vanguard of Western democracy in the Arab world, and that they all have a common strategy to offset Iranian influence, but also to overthrow secular and, in many instances, multi-party democracies in the Arab world. This is really what we have seen this year. The bottom line is that. Mm-hmm. That with all the faults, crimes, even in some instances, within mm-hmm. Egypt and so forth, at the end of the day, a 30-year president for life, Mubarak, is a terrible thing, but a 9-month-old Supreme Council of the Armed Forces headed up by Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tantawi is, as we're not seeing in the news, is hardly a better thing, is it?
Hardly. Yeah, it is a remarkable phenomenon. Rick, I really appreciate your ability to cover the whole territory. And I'm leaving somebody out. The other element here, and I've never understood how they work this out, Israel is not in NATO, but every time there's any kind of important meetings, they're there. How do they configure this?
Perhaps 2 years ago, I wrote an article called Israel Global NATO's 29th Member. And it is a...
It's like a silent partner or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's a de facto member of NATO insofar as it wants to be. Mm-hmm. In other words, it would be disadvantageous to be known. I'm thinking of the line by the French writer in the 1600s, La Bruyere, who once wrote pretty convincingly that it's a good thing to be a philosopher, but a better thing not to be known as one. And it's a good thing to be, from the Israeli military's point of view, to be to all but have an embassy at NATO headquarters in Brussels, to have a very privileged relationship, within the alliance and so forth.
Yeah, keys to the washroom.
Yeah, there you go. But at the same time, not in its neighborhood, be seen as being, too closely integrated with NATO. And the same for NATO. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't want to be seen, in what's left of the Arab world, as being so close to Israel in particular as to alienate Arab countries they also want to dominate.
Yeah, and by the way, that's almost like the U.S. relationship to the International Tribunal. You would think, reading headlines, that the U.S. is a member, but they're not a member.
Uh-huh.
Of that.
There you go. Nor is Israel, signed onto the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
Oh, yeah, small embarrassing detail doesn't come up.
Or as you were alluding to earlier, that the eight Arab countries that the U.S. and NATO have the closest military and political relationships with, and those are the six Persian Gulf countries and the Gulf Cooperation Council, but also the other two monarchies in the Arab world, Morocco and Jordan, who have applied for membership in the Gulf Cooperation Council. That as you were somewhat comically alluding to, this is the vanguard of democratic and democracy, human rights, and secularism and respect for women. And
the editorial writers at the Star, the Globe, and the New York Times must get migraines trying to avoid these facts as a writer. They can write without mentioning these things.
Sure. I mean, they can take...
That's a talent.
A dubious and a demonic talent, but I suppose the talent.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful way to say it, a demonic talent. But you're the answer to these things. Stop NATO. It's a great site, Rick. We took advantage of you. You gave us an awful lot of time.
Well, thank you, Phil. I wish we could speak. Well, I wish we didn't have any of this to speak about, first of all, but as we do, I wish we had more time to sound the alarm.
Given what's about to unfold in all the places you alluded to, we're going to have to get back to you soon. So thank you very, very much for joining us.
It's always an honor to be on the program.
All right. Thank you. Rick Rozoff. RickRozoff.wordpress.com. Brilliant material. We're going to take a break, and we're going to have some announcements for you. Phil Conlon has joined us.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
We're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And check us out, taylor-report.com. You get to hear, you get a chance to listen. For example, the Rick Rozoff interview will be up, and I'm sure that many people will want to consult. The man is encyclopedic in his grasp of things. I'll tell you again, December the 2nd, we, together with others, are sponsoring, we, the Taylor Report, sponsoring talk by Glenn Ford, Friday, December 2nd, at Sid Smith, Room 21, 1700 St. George, and that's at 7 p.m. And you can go to the different book lists for information about this. And, Phil, you have some announcements.
Right. There's two other cultural announcements. This Thursday, November 24th, at 6:30 p.m. at a different book list, is going to be a book launch, From Colonialism to Capitalism Democracy, A Failed Option for Trinidad, by author and political journalist Raymond Watts. And if you can come to a different book list, 746 Bathurst Street, Thursday the 24th, that's this Thursday, please RSVP to the bookstore, let them know you'll be there. Again, Colonialism to Capitalism Democracy, A Failed Option for Trinidad, by author and political journalist Raymond Watts. This is the launch of a book. And on this this weekend, there is the Canadian Labor International Film Festival, CLIF, and that is going to be at Innes Town Hall, 2 Sussex Avenue, which is the University of Toronto campus, and in particular, 2 o'clock on Saturday, the film Triangle, Remembering the Fire. This is the 100th anniversary of the famous Triangle Fire, and this is a documentary about that fire. For more information, go to www.laborfilms.ca. Labor, of course, has a U in it. This is Canadian Labor Films.
Oh, it's a Canadian Labor. there's extra labor there.
Extra labor, that's right.
Someday we're going to talk about the development of the Webster's Dictionary and the battle against what they thought
against
was
the U.
they were fighting U. They were fighting the British spelling and language.
Right. Phil, would you allow me just one moment for a cultural note of something that is...
As long as it's not a moment of silence, go ahead.
So upsetting, even by what they do in New York City routinely, but that Mayor Bloomberg had his police seize a library at Zuccotti Park at Occupy Wall Street and burn it.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
They burned a library?
Yeah, they burned a library. Well, this is what our friends at Occupy Wall Street are telling us. He says, no, we didn't burn it. We just dumped it in a dumpster. And when we realized what we did, we went and got them out of the dumpster.
Yeah.
So in Occupy Wall Street says,
so now stolen their books.
That
he didn't burn them. He stole them.
Well, they said they got 10% of them back and they're all waterlogged.
So is he.
Yeah. But I think our listeners should contemplate the armed agents of a state seizing books and destroying them, whether it's by burning or dumping.
Well, because it always comes down to they have to show, and that's what it, you know, that kind of thinking leads to. You have to show somebody, and you have to harm them and or abuse them, as in the case of University of California, Davis, where a campus policeman took pepper spray and there were peaceful demonstrators, and they walked up to them and sprayed them in the face.
They walked down a line, and people sat there without moving.
Like they were bugs.
And this cop just systematically sprayed every one of them. And the provost university says that they didn't do anything wrong. You know, she's not going to resign. You know?
I have to attribute to Sam, the local resident genius here, who said that it's one nation under pepper spray. If they have enough pepper spray, they can rule the place. Well, incidentally, the camp in Toronto has been ordered closed by a Toronto judge who I thought used very curious language. He said Canada has not chosen anarchy.
Yes. Well, but who they're not
neither,
reporting.
Neither had the campers, by the way.
Who they're not reporting is who this judge is. This isn't just any judge. This is the judge who, that when he was appointed to the bench, because of his connection with extreme right-wing Christian groups, caused a lot of disquiet. It was actually a controversial appointment. He used to do pro bono work for people who were opposed to choice. And
well, he certainly chose ideology. Right, why make an absurd comment like that? Actually, all the editorial writing and interviews and whatnot. You know, that camp was visited by many leading Canadians, and I take my hat off to Gordon Lightfoot, wonderful, great figure in world music and in Canada, songwriter, went there. His daughter was participating. I don't think either one of them are anarchists. I think the judge has a problem. He's scratching himself where, you know, the rest of us don't itch. It's a problem. And it's an odd mental, you know, approach. Mm. But I have to say, the media here has been very nervous about, unhappy with these, with the Occupy movement, and they've been patronizing them, making fun of them, trying to block. But in fact, they've hit a nerve, which everybody understands, where we have a concentration of wealth in a tiny group of people, and that wealth, of course. As they say, money talks, and it talks all over the place where people can't get a word in edgewise. When it does talk, it tends to abuse people. And as, of course, Ms. Rick Rosoff pointed out to us, that money is talking about buying nuclear submarines put under the ice, but they're meanwhile raising tuition fees for students so they can't go to university, or offering them loans and then saying you have to pay back at exorbitant, extraordinary rates, which destroy them. It wipes out their future. Somebody had a great sign at the Toronto site. It said, welfare shouldn't be a career choice. By the way, it is a wonderful and ongoing. If they think they're going to, you know, blow out the candle, they're mistaken. Probably it's going to lead to at least one good song by Gordon Lightfoot and a lot of other people. And another person I saw a photo of who went down, I got to congratulate her, is Olivia Chow was there. So a little more respect for Canadians who are speaking out on behalf of all of us about an unequal social structure we should all demand that. So at any rate, this is going – in Montreal, I understand there have been some rulings, but not – they haven't ordered them to leave the park. But they're getting it at the thing of – you can't build a three-floor. It can't be more than 18 floors. Yeah. Maybe at the end of this, they're just worried about property, right? In other words, suppose they stay. There must be a lawyer saying, you know, pretty soon they could be building things and running restaurants.
Oh, for sure. There's a lawyer telling
and,
you that.
And we'd lose out on that, Chief, because we plan to put a McDonald's on one corner, a Tim on another one, and a Starbucks in the other.
Well, you know, Phil, one of the interesting things about Judge Brown is in his ruling is that he kind of says that there's two classes of people, those who ordinarily use the park and those who are in there now. And that it really belongs to the people who are complaining in that sense, and it's not taking
every kind of Canadian is in that park
exactly. But he's taking the concept. Well, they're privileged people. It reminds me that one of the things that was accomplished in the Iranian Revolution was that there were parks in Tehran that were reserved
private parks
reserved for certain elite class of people.
Almost every city used to have, and matter of fact. Some that do now.
Right. And that got taken away. And so a lot of the people who came here to live in North America said, oh, that was a tyrannical revolution because they took away our private park in downtown Tehran, right? Mm-hmm. And now we find that there are people who think that St. James Park is their private park, right?
Yes.
But of course, it isn't their private park. And even if they did buy a $1 million condo in the neighborhood, I've lived in the community for 20 years. I've used that park for 20 years. And I'm thrilled to have those folks in the park. And I don't feel in any way that my enjoyment of the park has been lost.
Yeah, you know? They're using the old police trick of finding one guy who's not happy, and then they say, well, okay, make out a writ in his name, and we'll go and overthrow this thing, instead of just being quietly respectful of everybody and advancing it. Anarchism, by the way, doesn't aim for the occupation of one public park. That really, I would tell the judge, he had to read a few books. Start with Peter Kropotkin, who is, could teach him a few things. Who, by the way, was a prince, Prince Peter Kropotkin, who actually urged us all to civilize ourselves, and produced the greatest anthropologist in modern times, Ashley Montague. was a student or a follower of Peter Kropotkin. If you could just show me the time there. I'm losing track of my Good. We have some time left. And I want to comment on something here. Last week on the program, we did we interviewed a good friend about Chris Black and another commentator on Rwanda. And I noticed that the Toronto Star of Saturday, I just want to update you to show why we can't get any information. The Saturday Toronto Star has an article, Rwanda Polishes Its Image and Everything Else. And they have a picture of Kagame and his wife. And the big thing is that he's into hygiene. He's a hygiene man. And the subtext is that line of thought is that he's trying to imitate Singapore, which is a subject worth going into sometime. But this is really nuts, frankly. And they featured this article, and it's all about how they want to modernize. And it's a fact. I hate to bring this up for people to know, but actually, in 1994, when they had to transfer through a war and massacres and whatnot of power, Rwanda had the best roads in Central Africa. One thing that people in the region tell you is that what was noticeable about Rwanda that was different from Uganda was different from Zaire / Congo and Burundi and Tanzania is that if you were in Rwanda, they had paved roads and they had phones that worked. Those are the two things that everybody noticed. So this guy didn't create any of that. He grabbed it by using an army. And so the Star treats us to an article that takes up more than half a page, and it talks about President Kagame. And they don't mention, as we did on this show last week, that there is a woman from Holland. She was a Rwandan living in exile who returned because they claimed it's a new democracy there. She returned and said, I want to become a candidate for president. The hygiene they've applied to her is to arrest her, shave her head, put her in a pink uniform, a prison uniform, and drag her into court with handcuffs on because she had the temerity to say, I want to run for president. And this article did all this little swabbing and cleaning of his image and neglects to mention that he has done that to her. They're part of his operation. I would say, well, you're just, one of his eyelids or you're his tongue or something because you're not telling us what he's done to democracy. And you're consciously not mentioning her. And we get that from the Star all the time, the Globe and everybody else. This is all them aiding and abetting. This is classic enabling of somebody to hold power. Because you've agreed not to talk about certain things. Just as Rick Rozoff pointed out to us, they don't mention that when we talk about Iran, should they have nuclear weapons, that Israel, of course, has nuclear weapons, a lot of them, and the means to deliver them, too, and that they didn't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They didn't sign it. And yet they're the ones who say they're going to take down Iran with consequences that anybody could tell you is going to be, unspeakable. And if you read you go to Rick Rozoff's site, Stop NATO, you'll see that it's more likely than not these things will happen. There's a bunch of, I understand there's skeptics here, no, it won't. But the problem is that there's a bunch of things that weren't going to happen. The destruction of Iraq, the destruction of Afghanistan, they all happened. We hear Mr. Panetta, who lectures us on how to be Canadians, you have to be good NATO people. He's talking about how many things we've learned during this war. And people say, which one are you talking about? And he's talking about, I think he means Afghanistan, where they've been more than 10 years. So this is the place we're living. Let's just tell you again, remember, Glenn Ford, the brilliant editor and man with one of the most beautiful voices you're ever going to hear of a Black Agenda Report. I recommend you go to his site. He's going to be here December the 2nd and at Sydney Smith, 100 St. George at 7 p.m. and different book list and Otis Richmond and Charles Roach, African Women and Family, also of CIUT.